So while Contagion isn't a great episode of the show, I will have to give it points for the most audacious beginning of any Star Trek episode we've seen so far, which is the destruction of a ship that looks exactly like the one that we're watching the show about.
Okay.
Other than that, I find this a remarkably middling episode of The Next Generation.
I would agree with that. There wasn't anything really bad per se about it, but there wasn't anything it did well.
It was just kind of like watching wallpaper.
It was a wasted opportunity because, I mean, as we were saying, I remember we were saying the other week, like, after that big introduction of the Romulans and that really cool scene where they're like, you know, we've let matters go far too long, you know, we're back, you know, and then they haven't been in the second season at all. Like, they should have been every other episode. The Romulans, you know, sticking their... The Romulans should be the Metrons, but without their power. That's what they think they are, I think. And,
yeah,
you know, they should be going in and trying to stop Starfleet at every turn just because it's Starfleet, you know? And yet, in this episode, their ship is just as crippled. They're almost pathetic in a way.
Yeah, we'll go into that. What do you mean by you think the Romulans should be more like the Metrons?
The Romulans see themselves, based on that... that speech at the end of which episode was that? The finale.
The Neutral Zone?
Yeah. At the end of The Neutral Zone, their speech is basically, again, they say, you know, we've been away for a while. We've been attending to our own matters, but things are out of hand here. They see their way of life as the proper way of life. They see themselves as the more cultured civilization, which is that's a fairly standard conqueror trope. But that said, I think the Romulans see themselves as the stewards of peace and order in the galaxy. They are very warlike. They are very duty-like, but they're doing this for a good reason in their mind. And yet they don't have the raw power of the Metrons as we see the Metron, you know, I don't know. What do we feel about the Metrons? Do they have the right to be judging humanity in that episode?
Well, they seem like kind of vindictive dicks, so I would say no.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, there's something there. I think you're picking up on something, and I think you've got...
Yeah.
A lot of the Romulan psyche down. I would argue with you a little bit in saying that the Romulans are warlike. I don't necessarily think of them as warlike. I think of them as preparing to fight, but not necessarily needing it.
They're not averse to using force to get or to promote the peace.
Right.
Which is different from warlike.
What we've ever seen of Romulans is almost the opposite, right? It doesn't seem like they're conquerors. It almost seems like there's some... They view Romulans, like the Metrons viewed themselves, as this exalted species above all others. And so it doesn't even make any sense for them to really conquer. It seems like they want to spread out Romulan colonies throughout the galaxy as far as they can and sort of like... They see the Romulans as the ultimate and sort of like tame the galaxy in that way.
Yeah.
Whereas the Federation is very diametrically opposed to that idea. You know, the Federation is multiculturalism. So
that's fair. Yeah. I mean, and certainly I'm not saying the Romulans are in a lot of ways. I think they're not necessarily paper tigers, but they don't have the moral, the technological, they don't really have the authority in any sense to back that up.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, take that a step further. I mean, think about the origin of the Romulans in general, where, you know, we find out in their very first appearance, Balance of Terror, that they are at least related to in some fashion Vulcans.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether or not they're some sort of offshoot of Vulcans or whether, you know, we don't have any sort of specifics on that.
Or is there a third, you know, progenitor kind of race in a way?
They might even view themselves as some sort of like, you know, perfection of Vulcans, for example.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like the last step in evolution or something.
Yeah, they are definitely an arrogant race.
Yeah, I think arrogant is a good word to use for them.
Yeah.
And you know, this is all an interesting discussion, but I think it's...
But it's not used.
Well, it's germane to Contagion because I think, you know, the episode is very interested in telling this story about a mysterious alien race that disappeared, you know, 200,000 years ago or whatever they say in this episode, the Iconians, and this sort of race to find their technology. Number one, why not just use the Takan from The Last Outpost? Like, that would have been a nice little nod to continuity in some respects. I guess they forgot about that.
I forgot about that.
Well, right. Yeah, maybe everybody forgot about it. I'm the only one that...
What are we talking about?
Remember the guy at the end of The Last Outpost where he's like, oh, you guys are the best and we're not gonna hurt you, but the Ferengi, oh, they're so weird. This is not ringing a bell at all?
No. Are we still trying to make the Ferengi happen? Is that...
We haven't seen them in a while, so
I'm
I guess not.
I'm so glad about it.
And I think the next time you see the Ferengi, they probably will still try to make them happen. But it doesn't take... It doesn't happen much longer than this. You know, probably like in another couple of seasons, Star Trek has figured out that the Ferengi are comic relief, even though the Ferengi are not funny. But anyway, we'll have plenty to say about the Ferengi when we get to the, Deep Space Nine, because we have several Ferengi regular characters.
Eric, I really, you're huckstering me through this entire thing. Like, I feel like you might have even created Star Trek, the franchise, just to fuck with me.
I may have. This is all just a holodeck simulation.
This is like the worst prank I've ever been involved in.
Star Trek is really awful, and I don't like it. But I've spent so much time on it in my life that I need to share it with someone else.
No. It's like Vegemite, where like no one actually eats Vegemite, but it's a thing that, you know, Australians make fun of tourists and like, oh, try this. It's delicious.
Yeah. Well, you know, when Star Trek is really bad, Star Trek is bad like nothing else.
Yeah.
When Star Trek is really good, Star Trek is really good like nothing else.
And that's fair.
And, you know, if you're looking, I mean, you know, we've talked about this before, but it's... Star Trek is not one thing. Star Trek is multiple things, you know, sort of like interpreted and translated by, you know, hundreds of people over almost 50 years. And so, yeah, you're going to get some unevenness in that. It's just, you know, it's more like, I don't know, like, you know, looking at the whole run of a Superman comic or something and saying, well, you know, Superman from 1956 to 1959 really sucked. And it's like, okay, but a lot of different people worked on it. It's just that kind of thing.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
How long have we been talking so far? And how long has that has been talking about the actual episode in question? Because I think that says a lot about Contagion, though.
I'm about to bring it back to Contagion, actually. What I find so disappointing about this episode, really, is that there's no sense of... throughput. There's no sense of moving forward. They're just sort of, everyone just sort of seems to be blundering around. And, you know, the Yamato, which is said to be the Enterprise's sister ship, who apparently is staffed by incompetence, blows up for apparently no reason.
Now let me just ask a quick question. So they're talking about this design flaw on, you know, testing. So are the Enterprise and the Yamato the only two of that exact style of ship right now? Like, I knew the Enterprise...
The Galaxy class?
I knew the Enterprise was supposed to be, like, a new ship, basically.
There's more of them out there. The background is... I'm not completely versed on this because I'm not big into starships. But, I mean, I like them and everything.
Don't you have, like, four of them on your shelf and you get a new one every month with magazines that you make me put in the binder?
In terms of... Do I know the like megahertz warp output of the Excelsior class and the tonnage? And no, I don't know any of that. There's a lot of people that do, and God bless them because I love those people.
Please do not send us emails about answering this question, by the way.
But the Galaxy class, which is the class of starship that the Enterprise is and the Yamato is, was a new class of starship, but. Built at the Utopia Planitia yards around Mars, but there are like six of them or something.
Okay, yeah, because that was just that, you know, makes it make a little more sense because they're saying, you know, this is a, is there a design flaw? Like, is it just, it runs, you know, 100,000 miles and then it just blows
up? It's like they've all been in service for like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
basically.
So this is that, and that's why I guess they're all worried about this time.
Yeah, there's no 20-year-old Galaxy class starships floating around.
But there's also not, it's not like everybody has one and, you know, there would be more of this happening.
Right, exactly. There's not 70,000 of them out there.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. It's a very small number. So, you know, the Yamato sort of crew, and again, you know, you get this sort of Star Trek thing where every other starship crew besides the one that we're watching the show on is basically incompetent. So that's lazy, I think. Then we have Picard making this really random and out of character decision to just go, all right, let's go back into the neutral zone and let's just find this planet. What? Like, based on like 10 second snippets of like six personal logs from the captain who didn't seem very good at his job, who's now dead and can't explain any of this.
You see, here's the thing with Picard is suddenly Picard has an interest in archaeology, which has been a lifelong passion of his. And like, they almost seem to be figuring this out as the episode's going along, because like by the end they've saying, well, Picard loves this planet, and this is like he's, you know, been the equivalent of someone who's been reading stories about Atlantis for years.
Yeah.
You know? He's that obsessed with that that if he finds something that's a scrap, like, which would be fine if that had, but like again, even 20 minutes earlier in the episode, it just seems like, oh, I read a couple books about that when I was younger. It was really interesting, you know. Wonder whatever happened. That would be really cool to find someday, you know.
Well, it's kind of like how Riker, you know, was established to read everything about ships named Enterprise for some reason, and then that's never brought up again.
Yeah,
like that, know, would be really interesting and useful information to bring up a lot, but it never comes up again.
See, to one degree, you know, I get that. That's a TV thing. That's fine. You know, all the time. I mean, all the time, you know, TV shows are doing something for as a plot device. Okay. But the thing is, it's not like he's – it's not like they beam onto the planet at the beginning of the episode and they're trapped on the planet and he's talking about this obsession. No, he makes a series of very questionable decisions under the flimsiest of pretenses in order to – justify the and so, yeah, as you say, it's out of character. It's we haven't seen Picard as the kind of man who would chase an obsession in this way.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean,
the episode Obsession with Kirk, that was something we'd never heard mentioned before, but he justified it, was justified within the episode, and we figured, okay, Kirk is the kind of man who will not go by the book, or he will take an extreme risk if he feels that it's right. And okay, you know, yeah, we never mentioned his obsession with this particular thing before, but I can dig it, and it's good with it. Yeah, it doesn't really seem like Picard's deal.
Well, it seems like, yeah, I agree with you, and I also think it seems like they're trying to justify his actions in this episode by creating this interest in archaeology out of whole cloth, basically. And so that's something that I feel like if they had thought to seed that throughout the character in the previous season and a half, it might have made a bit more sense. Like, Picard is very level-headed. Picard is very even. He makes really good decisions 95% of the time, or 99% of the time. But on this one thing, his childlike wonder gets the better of him and he gets a little obsessed. Yeah. Like, I can see where they were going with it. Yeah. I just don't think that they set it up very well. I didn't notice it really because, you know, it's funny. There are certain character beats, like the whole French thing, and he talks in French sometimes and stuff like that, where these things are dropped, really.
Yeah.
And the archaeology thing is something that is seeded throughout the show. And
this is kind of the first.
That's the first time they ever mention it. But it is something that they build on as well.
And maybe if they keep with that in two seasons from now, if he makes a rash decision in order to sate this need, you know, that might work. It might just be that this is the first time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, another question. This is the first time. I know Earl Grey tea is a thing of his. Is this the first time we hear this?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. I like that little scene.
I made a note of that. I actually, you know, I want to get back to the Romulans, but I do want to talk about that scene now that you bring it up with Wesley, because I liked that scene. Like, I feel that was
a really good scene.
I feel like that was the one scene in the show, in this particular episode, that really was well written and felt organic and felt true to the characters. Because, you know, Wesley is a character that I think they were trying to make happen in the first season, and they sort of realized that, okay, this isn't really happening. And they've sort of repivoted and retconned his character in the second season a bit. He's not supposed to be as brilliant as he was in the first season. Yeah. He's a bit older. You know, he's an acting ensign, he's driving the ship, which, okay. And, you know, but at the same time, I like this episode because it remembers that he's a teenager. It remembers that he hasn't gone through the rigorous training that every other officer on the Enterprise has. And he would be freaked out by this. You know, his captain is bringing them deeper into the neutral zone to go on some quixotic adventure to find a dead planet so that the Romulans don't get powerful technology and can take over the galaxy. I buy that he would be squigged out by this.
It's a very different thing for Riker to do something which he can get him killed. He knows what that decision means, and he's gotten to the point where he can accept that consequences. Yeah, Wesley hasn't gotten there yet just because he's younger. He doesn't necessarily know if he's ready to make that sacrifice yet. He's not old enough to.
Right.
And yet he is kind of, yeah. And I like also how Picard acts to him, because Picard is not a fuzzy person, and it's not the fuzziest of speeches, and yet he is kind to Wesley. He speaks to him in a very adult way. You know, he doesn't talk down to him.
He
doesn't sugarcoat it at all, you know, and he does, you know, it is that the speech is basically a look, adults don't have it all figured out, you know, that kind of thing. And he does, you know, that telling a teenager that is a sign that you respect them enough to give them that lesson, you know. I think Wesley is the kind of precocious kid who, once he's in the real world, isn't so exceptional anymore, I think.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he may have been doing, you know, years ahead of his class, but now he's doing stuff with, you know, other people who were years ahead of their class and have had 20 years of experience on a starship over him. So, yeah, I think he's in a good place because he's been a tiny bit more humble this season, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
I
think that's a good way to put it. And, you know, I don't necessarily know that they ever really figure Wesley out as a character. And eventually he does leave the show. But it scenes like this make me wish that they had figured him out. Because I think if they had figured his character out, he would have added something interesting to the show that I don't know if the show necessarily needs, because, of course, you know, the show does get very good, and this side of Wesley we don't see very much. But on the other hand, it would have been an interesting addition, I think.
No, I agree with you. And it would be interesting to see what kind of an adult someone like that does become, because what happens when, you know, that's the thing. When you are given a lot of praise at a young age, you either end up becoming very cocky or you end up becoming terrified and unable to, you know. Yeah, is Wesley the kind of person who would end up getting very arrogant, and would he be that engineer who from the early season episode, I mean, we said that,
like, where no one has gone before. Yeah.
Yeah. Like we were saying, like
Kaczynski.
That's Wesley in 20 years. If no one's checking him, you know,
24% of my brain is taken up by remembering things from Star Trek, by the way.
you can just
assume that I'm going to blurt them out.
I figured you would. That's why I said, you know, yeah, that's a very possible future for Wesley. But again, you can also see him crippled from, you know, again, at age 15, he is told, you are so smart at engines, you know, you need to, and you could see him not being able to, you know, cracking under that.
Yeah.
You can also see a version of him which rides, and I believe that, you know, knowing what I know about the show, they would have the version of Wesley which is able to ride it, and who does develop into a very capable officer. But
I bet Geordi would like that.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's interesting because a better version of this episode, I think, would have made that a bit more explicit. I think that, you know, like we said a couple of episodes ago, where the show is starting to do some sort of character-based drama with Unnatural Selection and A Matter of Honor and The Measure of a Man, where, you know, these are episodes primarily about character. They're not really about the plot so much. And this is definitely a plot episode. This is not a character episode. I think that, you know, we're talking a lot about how Picard, the Enterprise, the Yamato, the Romulans are all just sort of tooling around, being kind of incompetent, not really doing a whole lot. And while Wesley realizes that he's scared and he's probably not as good as he thinks he is.
Well, that's the thing. Wesley might be able to see physics, you know, like it, but he's socially, he's a kid.
Well, no, take that a step further. I think that a better version of this episode would have tied all that together and said, just as Wesley isn't as good as he thinks he is, perhaps everybody else needs to be a bit more humble as well.
That's fair.
You know, and we don't get that in this episode. What we get is a bunch of stuff that just kind of happens, and it's a shame. Especially considering the fact that, you know, going back to the Romulans, because they are in this episode, you know, the Romulans make this big show of talking about how they want the Enterprise to leave the neutral zone. And, you know, oh, well, I'm not going to leave. You know, Picard says, I'm not going to leave until I find out what happened to the Yamato, which is fair. And then he decides to go further into the neutral zone. What I wondered is, did he think that the Romulans had left? Like, what was he thinking? Like, because, you know, they told him to leave, and then for him to go further into the neutral zone.
And doesn't he say, like, you know, we're having some problems, you know, and they're based, you know, doesn't he say like they're having some problems and she's kind of like, look, get out of here once you fix your ship, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and so he's like, they're there by the Romulan sufferance. Like, the Romulans will be okay for if they stay there a day or two, like, and kind of hang out
but
in
they,
that area.
But no, but they, no, she said that after they left to go to the Iconian planet, though. They weren't having problems then. So it doesn't, it makes even less
sense. Yeah, that's true.
They go into the neutral zone. They go light years more into the neutral zone to go to this planet. The Romulans are like, we claim this planet for Romulus. And he's like, no, you don't. It's in the neutral zone, guy. It's like, come on. What the hell am I watching?
Like, I guess, yeah. And part of the fact that I can't remember exactly the order of everything that happened is that says a lot.
I think we need to talk about the Iconians. Because I think they're a problem.
Yeah, okay.
Like, what exactly? Like, I can get what they were trying to do with the Iconians. They're a super powerful race that has some sort of trans-dimensional transporter technology. Okay. It seems like a really good way to travel. It seems much faster than going through a starship. And it also seems easy to invade people.
Yeah,
I can see why they wouldn't want the Romulans.
The military applications and the, you know, travel applications.
I mean, except for the fact that only one or two people can pass through at a time, and it, you know, to get a whole army through would take days.
Yeah, but that said,
and all you need is like four snipers just at the place and just being like, you know, picking off the army as they come through.
Yeah, but that said, the, you know, the implication was that the Iconians invented this probably, yeah, just for travel type purposes or to, you know, make commuting easier. And, you know, they weren't a really militaristic race. You have someone who's interested in explicitly using that for military technology. They'll find a way to make it bigger. They'll find a way to make it, or, you know, maybe they'll make multiple. I don't know. I just get the sense that it hadn't been weaponized yet, but it could be in a way. And hey, it doesn't need to be an army. It could be a bomb.
That's true. It could be a bomb. Yeah, it could be a lot of things, right?
I would say
if you make it big enough, you could send a starship through.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of things you could do with it.
Yeah.
You know, I just find it problematic because, you know, again, the Iconians are painted as this sort of like dead race that was very powerful and sort of all powerful. And, you know, Picard makes this point of saying that, well, the history is written by the victors and, you know, okay, we all know this stuff. And so maybe the Iconians actually weren't these conquerors. We don't know one way or the other, really.
We learn nothing about their society.
We don't know anything about their society except for this one room. I mean, Data does make the observation that the room they're in doesn't seem to be any sort of military command center, and it's probably just sort of like their equivalent of a train station.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
But that could also, you could also go into Earth 2014 and, you know, see a train station and conclude that the entire race of humans has never been to war.
Right.
You know, that's
And so for me, it's like, again, the Iconians are one of those Deus Ex Machina things in Star Trek where it just sort of is way too powerful, comes out of nowhere, yeah. And yet nobody ever does anything with it. And especially considering the fact that in the better version of the episode that I'm writing in my head, the sort of, you know, subtext of the episode would be no one is as good as they think they are. I think the Iconians aren't as good as they think as they thought they were either, of course, because that they were destroyed. And Picard does make this offhanded comment about how, well, maybe not all the Iconians are dead because they could have escaped through this portal. Okay. But I don't really get the sense that it matters all that much.
I was going to say, it's if that eventually becomes a, well, it turns out the Iconians are the progenitor race of Vulcans and Romulans. You know, that would be a thing. Or something like that. Like, or they eventually find a lost Iconian colony. Like, if something like that happened, maybe I would give a shit. But I'm getting the sense that that's not where they go with it.
Yeah. I mean, so it's all kind of just pointless, really. This is kind of a pointless episode.
This was an original series. A bad original series episode.
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. I think in a lot of ways, both episodes this week are sort of bad original series episodes.
After that Measure of a Man thing, like, I'm pissed.
It's a big come down.
I would love to see I would just really wish this episode would have just been Geordi flailing around the elevator for the entire time of it. I want to see the unedited version. All right, run, jump to the other side of the wall and pour the bar.
Well, that's the other thing. This episode has some very tonally off comedy in it. Like Picard's bizarre, what's a starship captain like you doing in a place like this? Hey, Picard, our ship's about to explode. Maybe you don't want to joke around right now. All right, sorry. Or the scene where Geordi is getting electrocuted and Data rescues him, and then it turns into a slapstick comedy for 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's like the opposite
what
of
is
that.
Going on?
I'm just remembering the Scotty scene from, what is it?
Oh, Star Trek V.
Yeah, where he hits his head. You're like, oh, and then at the dinner, they have a trauma team in. Like,
and also, it's just stupid because Scotty knows the ship. No, it's so funny because Scotty knows the ship like his back of his hand, and he gets his head on something because he didn't realize. It's like, yeah, okay, this is stupid.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much how, like, that, this, the comedy bits of this episode came off.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Star Trek doesn't really do comedy well.
Well, it does, like, I'm thinking about Mudd's Women. I'm thinking, you know, like, when it does come...
Well, let me revise that statement.
New Next Gen?
Star Trek post the original series.
Okay.
Doesn't do comedy very well.
Yeah, because it seems to be that this next generation's view of what comedy is...
Is Joe Piscopo.
Yeah, I would say, is Joe Piscopo doing an impression of Jerry Lewis, and then you have Data putting on a funny hat and talking in a voice?
Yeah, pretty much. 4. Iconian Gateways.
3.5.
All right, well, let's move on to our final episode for this week, The Royale.
So I woke up this morning and I thought, oh shit, I have to watch Star Trek, you know, because I'm recording. So then I remembered, oh wait, no, actually, I watched it last night. So then I thought, no, I watched some really shitty gangster movie last night, actually. I'm like, no, that was Star Trek.
I love The Royale.
I don't. You know, I don't know what you want me to want from you. Like, I didn't know. This is with Alternative Factor and, you know, the Troy's Mother episode. And I fucking hated this.
I don't know why I like it so much.
Yeah, like,
it's in a lot of ways, it is a season 3, the original series episode translated to the next generation.
Yeah.
It's done extremely cheaply. I mean, even to the effect that, like, the Royale door in the black is kind of like, you know, reminiscent of the Empath, for example.
I would say it's literally an undressed soundstage with, like, two props.
Yeah. Yeah, like the Vegas set is obviously just like a soundstage with some, like, padding on the wall, you know, and they throw in some roulette tables and shit.
Most likely that was a set for something else that
they actually built that.
Really?
Yeah, they did.
Oh
yeah.
Wow, I figured they would have saved money. Like, oh, they were, you know, filming a movie about a
they actually built that.
That's so sad.
The dirty little secret of Hollywood is that they don't really have standing sets. Like,
they don't
really have a lot of, like, ready-made sets lying around, like,
but I figured, like, it was one of those, like, the way I thought the episode made sense is, like, they had this set, like, that they were filming, like, we're gonna take this down next week, but, you know, we need an episode, and we've got a week, so let's do an episode there. You know, spend 15 minutes and write a script for us. Like, I thought that was the genesis of this episode.
Well, it's interesting, because I do want to talk about the actual episode, but, you know, I was thinking about this. We haven't really talked about the writers of The Next Generation as much as we did the original series for some reason, and I think this is a good episode to sort of maybe start that, or at least mention it, because, you know, I think part of the reason why we haven't done it is just that most of the writers of the second season don't stick around for very long. They're all gone, and then the show gets really good, and so, you know, we'll start talking about Michael Piller and Ronald D. Moore and these kind of people. But
there haven't been any episodes that I'm like, I really want to know, oh, did that person... The only time I've asked, did someone else write, did he write another episode, is so that I can, you know to brace myself when it comes up. Like, for the most part, that's how it's been.
Yeah, and so Tracy Torme, who was Mel Torme's son, was, I think, one of the, like, staff writers, and I think he was maybe even a supervising producer. He had some kind of, like, high level job in The Next Generation, and, you know, he wrote a few episodes, and none of them are very good. But it's funny because this episode he wrote, and He used a pseudonym on it because he wrote an original script and then they rewrote it entirely pretty much. And he was totally not happy with the way that it turned out. Right. Exactly. And eventually this is what led to him leaving the show. So, so even if you don't like the Royale as an episode, I think you should appreciate it for what it provided the Next Generation, which is getting rid of Tracy Tornay.
I was going to say it was that bad that they fired. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that's interesting about this is that Melinda Snodgrass, who wrote The Measure of a Man, is now a story consultant on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Okay.
I don't know that we've seen much in the way of evidence that she's been helping the show in any way so far, but she's there at least.
Well, I mean, even maybe it was even little things like, again, you said the architecture thing, archaeology thing and the hot tea thing, like maybe... You know, even stuff like that could have been her contributions, maybe.
That could be, yeah.
Like, you know, she maybe, yeah, you know, we were saying about Data, you know, she has some ideas about her. So, yeah, you know, about, you know, what Starfleet really is and what, you know, Data thinks about. So, yeah, maybe that was during a meeting. She's like, you know, I really picture, you know, Picard needs a signature drink. I can see him barking Earl Grey tea hot, you know, into
yeah.
it. You know, like stuff like that may have been her.
That could be, yeah. So getting back to the Royale.
Do we have to?
I understand why you don't like
it. No, and this is totally one of those, I love cheesy episodes, and I don't know why you liked this one and I didn't.
I honestly don't know, and perhaps we can walk through it together and try and figure
this
out.
That's, I think, a good exercise.
Part of it could just be that I have seen this episode a lot, and I've seen it since I was a kid, and I've always appreciated it because of various reasons that I can't really explain. Perhaps it's nostalgia. Perhaps I'm colored by the fact that I've seen it multiple times. And if I had seen it for the first time as a 33-year-old man, I would absolutely hate it. I don't have an answer for that. I just think that in terms of the way the script is put together, the way that it uses the hotel as an interesting environment to tell this, you know, rather cliched, admittedly, and rather uninteresting science fiction mystery story. And I think it's one of the examples of The Next Generation doing comedy well, perhaps the only one. And I'm grading on a curve, admittedly, because The Next Generation never really does comedy all that well. I'm thinking perhaps of an episode like Cupid, which, yeah. But
you know, oh, no, don't tell me they actually meet Cupid.
No. Just leave it alone. Yeah, just no.
They meet Cupid.
They don't meet Cupid. No. Oh. You're missing it, but it's fine. You'll find out in a couple weeks, or actually no, more like a couple months. I don't know when the hell that episode was. Third season, fourth season, fifth season, who knows. I don't know, it all kind of runs together in my head. I don't like it when Brent Spiner hams it up. He's hamming it up a little bit in this episode, but I find it charming instead of creepy, perhaps because he's not playing a homicidal maniac like he did with Lore, the guy in the Scheisse Man. I like the combination of Worf, Riker, and Data on an away team. They each have a different dynamic, and it cheers me up to know when to watch this episode. I don't know.
I mean, I did like the way that they all have extremely different reactions to this. Like, I like how Worf is just confused and he's like trying to interpret everything in terms of, you know, what he knows. Like, we can take the turbo lift there, it's not working, you know. And Riker, who, you know, he knows about this because he's probably, you know, read, he's, you know, because he's familiar with this, you know, period of time, you know, from reading stuff probably, or seeing, you know, movies or whatever. And so he's amused as hell about it, you know. And anytime you see Worf trying to, you know, puzzle something together, it's, you know, making Riker laugh. You know, like, I like that. I like that, you know, Data is, I like that none of them at the beginning are taking it at all seriously. Like, they're just kind of like rambling through in a way, you know, they recognize that this isn't really real.
Right.
They're not playing in character.
I think it's interesting because I think it's kind of like a holodeck episode without holodeck. And I like that because they're not in control of it and there's no possible reason that they could be. Right. And so.
No, if they want to get trapped in a holodeck, yeah, that it doesn't make sense when it's controllable technology, but when it's.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it seems like a Golden Girls set. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, especially the hallway upstairs. All of the I like it because all of the characters are obviously poorly written, but they're poorly written in a way that I find really fun. They're all sort of like these, you know, and they even go, they even explicitly say this in the episode.
This is
a badly written book, and it is, you know, the astronaut that dies says that, look, I'm stuck in this horrible cliched thing, and I will welcome death when it comes. And what food is he eating? Where's he going to the bathroom?
Well, it's a casino. They have food and bathroom there.
Yeah, but nothing is real. So is it like, does it keep him alive? Like, do the aliens know what kind of amino acids and proteins this guy needs to eat? Like, I don't know.
That the book had, you know, had a scene where they go to dinner at some point.
Yeah, but if someone describes what a turkey dinner looks like and smells like and tastes like, can you make it out of nothing and have it be
if you're an alien, you can.
And have it be nutritionally valuable? I don't know.
Well, I mean, they like scanned his brain or something.
They killed all the other aliens.
Yeah, because they, but then they figured it out.
Accidentally, apparently.
Who
are these aliens? Where are they? Where did they go? Why didn't they just bring the guy back to Earth?
I just got the sense that nobody really, you know, that they didn't care about the plot at all, and they just wanted to have them. They wanted to have a scene where they just have Data playing craps. Like, Tracy Torme had this image in his mind, and he thought it would, you know, we can have a really broad comedy scene about Data playing craps or gambling or trying to learn blackjack. Okay, and like, then the rest of it is just like built around that scene, and it doesn't really make sense because nobody cares because they just think it's that funny to show Data.
I don't know. I think there's a looseness to the episode that I appreciate, and I think it's nice to see them not buttoned up as much.
See, here the thing for me, I mean, and you say they mention in the episode that it's cliche, and so that is a thing that bothers me. And it's a personal pet peeve, but I don't think you can justify a bad story by saying, yeah, well, we know it's a bad story. Okay, well, I'd rather you give me a good story, like. Why are you wasting my time?
So you wanted them to be stuck in Finnegan's wake?
I said a good story.
Oh.
I did not necessarily find it entertainingly bad enough. And I guess that's the thing, like, and I guess this is a subjective thing, like
I will say that the plot elements of the episode do seem a bit perfunctory, and a novel would have more plot than this, and there's nothing really happens in the episode aside from one or two scenes that last for like 20 or 30 seconds of the bellboy covertly talking to the front desk manager and saying things like, you know, Mickey D stole my girl or whatever the hell he says. Mickey D, really? Like, what?
I really wanted some chicken nuggets.
Like, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, did they not realize that? Okay.
Was it, and like, then, sponsored, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know. And then, you know, of course, like, then Mickey D comes in and shoots the bellboy and leaves. And they're like, how did he leave? And it's like, well, because he's part of the damn story, you idiots. Of course he can leave. He's not real. Like, what is your problem? And then, you know... It's maybe I'm talking myself into not liking this.
Good.
Know,
keep guests. Join me.
I'm
sorry this is being ruined for you, but it's not that funny of an episode, and it's a goddamn mess, is what it is.
No, it's a mess, and I think, you know, if the show had been more self aware, I think they could have played up that a little bit, because at least there's like an explanation for why Star Trek has been so underwritten or badly written so far. You know, because of course this episode is full of weird plot holes too, like how Data finds the book and reads it in a few seconds, and yet Riker is asking Picard what happens.
I love,
like, how long would it have taken Picard to like read the book? I mean, it's like 250 pages.
Well, he read a Wikipedia summary of it. Remember, they're all saying, like, I mean, and like when
it starts,
Data's
off,
look, Data is flipping through the book and he says, well, it's a tawdry tale of, you know, people, and he gives a summary of it. So like, he has summarizing skills too. Like, that's not just
it was a pretty good summary, I think, that he could work as a jacket guy.
Yeah,
you know. No, and so it's stuff like that where I'm just kind of like, well, why don't you just ask Data what to do? Like, you know, but you know, like I said, I think there's a looseness to it. I think that there's a level to which it's just sort of a fun episode because there really aren't any stakes. Yeah, they're stuck, but you know they're going to get out. The stuff on the Enterprise is sort of there to pad the episode a little bit where, you know, Geordi is, you know, tapping on the console and trying to, like, you know, remodulate the frequency to get them to talk to them. And, you know, it's all sort of like this, I guess it comes, it just kind of like all adds up to this sort of like Star Trek episode, which all of the parts are sort of cliched in them as well. And so it all kind of works together as some sort of metaphor for Star Trek as a whole.
It just,
maybe I'm being too grandiose. I don't know.
I would like to have seen the episode that realized that this was just a bad episode. You did just say, well, it was a bad episode. So, you know, this, but it was because it knew it was, I don't know. The only scene I really liked from that was when you have Troy and Picard sitting in the office and he's listening to all this because he's, you know, the terrified captain who's really worried and, you know, he wants to know every single thing that's going on. But also, again, we know him as a bit of an aesthete and he has read good literature and this is the opposite of anything he's liked. And he's just cringing and like she's staying there politely as long as she can take. And then she excuses herself like, and, you know, and he's almost like pissed that she has the right to leave. But, you know, he can't make her stay and he understands, you know, like that was the one scene I liked from this.
Yeah, Troy had a nice little moment. I mean, you know, I don't know. The only thing that I can really compare this to is Spock's Brain. And it's like everyone holds up Spock's Brain as the worst episode ever, blah, blah, blah. Really not. You know, we talked about it a while ago.
No, alternative factories.
Oh, my God. We both found it amusing. It's a stupid episode. It's not good, objectively and subjectively not good. But there's something about it which is just fun and kind of entertaining.
When you told me, you know, Alien Lady steals Spock's brain, it was exactly what I wanted that
right,
to be.
Exactly.
I guess when you say the, you know, the away team gets stuck in a tawdry 1980s casino based on a really bad novel, there is a hope that I would have from that. And this was not the episode that we got.
I suppose, but I mean, what would that episode look like then?
I don't know, but I think it would be,
I mean, because, you know, Spock's brain is not well written and this episode is not well written. And no. I just think that there's a level to which I recognize.
It's not campy enough, I think. And maybe the whole thing with the Fermat's Last Theorem on all of that. And like maybe if they had just figured they wanted to, I feel like they wanted to, you know, maybe that was it. Maybe there were two halves. One wanted to make a really broad comedy episode and then the other wanted to make a serious episode about, you know, and there's mysteries. And there is no mystery to this episode. It's just that Tracy Torme, again, wanted to see the away team in a casino in the 80s. And this was how he thought to do it. That's the big mystery.
Right.
There is no Fermat's Last Theorem era level quandary here.
Yeah, I didn't really get what the Fermat's Last Theorem stuff was about and why that was even in the episode. Like, that seemed very bizarre to me.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have any, like,
I think what they were going for is, you know, the universe is full of mysteries and you may never solve them.
Also, like, it's funny because Fermat's Last Theorem has been solved.
Yeah.
But, you know. All right,
but, you know, yeah, like, it's, if you know, Fermat's Last Theorem is, at least at the time, emblematic of an unsolvable problem, something that it does have an answer. It has an answer. There is an answer to this mystery, but we are never going to find it. And it is still and that is, you know, you say emblematic of Star Trek as a whole. The goal is never to, you know, and they do address this at several times throughout the franchise that we may never understand everything, but the goal is to explore a little bit more and shine a little bit more of a light. And there will always be something else that we'll never understand. But, you know, the joy and the success is in the effort. And, okay, that's fine. But, again, this is – and they figure out what the mystery of this place is. It's an alien creation designed to be a – you know, it's misguidedly designed to be a paradise for this guy.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, there's a degree to which I also wonder why they couldn't leave, right? Because it doesn't seem to really logically make any sense. I mean, the astronaut couldn't leave because there was nowhere to go, but there was no reason to, like, physically make him incapable of leaving.
Yeah, but
and
you
so,
got the sense, I got the sense that, you know, they hung out and they made sure his, and, you know, and maybe you talk about food, maybe they, you know, when they figured it out, they were, maybe they had more control over it when he was alive. They probably did have some beings actively monitoring him. And then he died.
God, that'd be a shitty job.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, to be fair, if you're a centuries-old alien, you know, the time it takes to monitor the sky is, you know, probably nothing in the grand scheme of things. But you know.
I mean, that again, we don't really know anything about the aliens, so they could just be
they're the Iconians, you know. They're the same race, alien race, in both episodes, really.
I don't know. I mean, I don't really get a sense from the episode that they're supposed to be like all powerful or something.
It doesn't really matter. Like they were aliens that were there and they did something.
I think there's a degree to which it does matter, because I think, you know, if they're constructing such a poorly realized environment for this guy to live in for 38 years, you know, why write this into the program where you can't physically leave the building unless you finish the story? I mean, that, you know, like,
and that was just a half-assed out of nowhere.
There's nowhere for him to go. So,
well, he wasn't taking the role of the foreign investor. I guess
the foreign investors are not in that's the weird thing, is that the foreign investors are not in the story. Like, mm-hmm. Everything else in the book is in the story except the foreign investors. And so it's almost like this sort of meta-textual thing about how Star Trek characters don't have a story unless they go to a planet and create the story. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's,
I guess
there's a lot of like weird meta-textual stuff going on in this episode that I don't know that anybody involved in writing it or making it really realized.
You know what would be funny, you know, because they mentioned at the very beginning that they're, you know, oh, we're foreign, you know, we're foreigners, you know, which is why that, you know, how they half-ass explain their outfits and the fact that they're unfamiliar and stuff like that. And you get the sense that at the end, they're in the writer's room at the end, and, you know, they're saying, well, how do we get them out of there? You know, okay, well, we had this throwaway line about them being foreigners. Well, let's say they're foreign investors, you know. Okay, and they leave and they go back home. Oh, easy enough. Like, it really just seems like they did it as a joke that they didn't really. This episode doesn't make any sense when you think about it. If you just watch it passively and don't analyze a lick of it, if you just let it happen, it's much better. I watched the show to analyze it and to understand it a little better, partially because of the podcast, but partially because that's what I watch TV for, and that's what Star Trek at this point earns. And
yeah.
I guess this episode doesn't deserve the attention that most good Star Trek episodes deserve.
I think you're starting to respect Star Trek a little bit.
Well, fuck you. I don't think Tracy Torme is.
No, I don't think so.
You know,
and frankly, the fact of the matter is, I think he writes one more episode of the show and then he's gone. So
good.
You know, it's at the end of the day, I just think this is a fine example of the show doing a bad episode that's fun. You don't like it, and that's fine.
Yeah, I liked the Scheisse Man. So
I'm just gonna give this 21.
Oh, I was going to say 21.
Because I like it.
Oh, I was going to say Snake Eyes.
Snake Eyes, there you go.
Yeah.
All right, well, next week we are talking about Time Squared and the Icarus Factor.
Ick.
We'll see you then.